Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info, hallel.info. Yaakov meets with Esau and becomes one again with his family. From there, Yaakov's family has to clean out the wickedness from their household. There's messianic symbolism in the sun forever. It points to God's son, the Mashiach Yeshua, who died in sorrow but was resurrected and sits at God's right hand forever. There are two hidden stories we will discover in the Torah section Vayishlach, which means, and he sent. The following discussion, led by Hallel Fellowship teacher Daniel, covers Genesis chapter 32, verse 4 through chapter 36. The accounts of Yaakov's wrestling, the heavenly visitor then facing Esau, fit with judgment on the rapist in Shechem to teach how God's Mashiach purges our past so we can overcome.
Then Jacob sent messengers ahead of him to Esau, his brother, to land of Seir, the field of Edom. He charged them, saying, "Thus shall you say to my lord, to Esau, so said your servant Jacob, I have sojourned with Laban, and have lingered until now. I have acquired oxen and donkeys, flocks, servants, and maidservants. I am sending to tell my lord to find favor in your eyes." The messengers returned to Jacob, saying, "We came to your brother, to Esau. Moreover, he is heading toward you, and 400 men are with him." Jacob became frightened and distressed him, so he divided the people with him, the flocks, the cattle, the camels, in two groups. For he said, "If Esau comes to one camp and strikes it down, then the remaining camp shall survive." Then Jacob said, "God of my father Abraham, and God of my father Isaac, Lord, who said to me, 'Return to your land and to your relatives, and I will do good with you,' I have been diminished by all the kindnesses and by all the truth that you have done for your servant. With my staff I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two camps. Rescue me, please, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he come and strike me down, mother and children. And you had said, 'I will surely do good with you, and I will make your offspring like the sand of the sea, which is too numerous to count.' He spent the night there, then he took from that which had come in his hand a tribute to Esau his brother, 200 she-goats and 20 he-goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 nursing camels with their colts, 40 cows and 10 bulls, 20 she-donkeys and 10 he-donkeys. He put his servants in charge of each drove separately and said to his servants, 'Pass on ahead of me and leave a space between drove and drove.' He instructed the first one, saying, 'When my brother Esau meets you and asks you, saying, "Whose are you? Where are you going? And whose are these that are before you?" You shall say, "Your servant Jacob's. It is a tribute sent to my lord, to Esau, and behold, he himself is behind us." Similarly, he instructed the second, also the third, as well as all those who followed the droves, saying, "In this manner shall you speak to Esau when you find him. You shall still say, "Moreover, behold, your servant Jacob is behind us." For he said, "I will appease him with the tribute that precedes me, and afterward I will face him. Perhaps he will forgive me." So the tribute passed on before him while he spent that night in the camp. But he got up that night and took his two wives, his two handmaids, his 11 sons, and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. When he took them, he had them across over the stream. He sent over his possessions. Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the break of dawn. When he perceived that he could not overcome him, he struck the socket of his hip. So Jacob's hip socket was dislocated as he wrestled with him. Then he said, "Let me go, for dawn has broken." And he said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." Then he said, "What is your name?" He replied, "Jacob." said, "No longer will it be said that your name is Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with the divine and with man and have overcome." Then Jacob inquired and said, "Divulge, if you please, your name." And he said, "Why then do you inquire of my name?" He blessed him there. So Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, for I have seen the divine face to face, yet my life was spared. The sun rose for him as he passed Penuel, and he was limping on his hip. Therefore the children of Israel are not to eat the displaced sinew on the hip socket to this day, because he struck Jacob's hip socket on the displaced sinew. Chapter 33. Jacob raised his eyes and saw, and behold, Esau was coming, and with him were 400 men. So he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and two handmaids. He put the handmaids and their children first, Leah and her children next, and Rachel and Joseph last. Then he himself went on ahead of all of them and bowed earthward 7 times until they reached his brother. Esau ran toward him, embraced him, fell upon his neck, and kissed him. Then they wept. He raised his eyes and saw the women and children. He asked, "Who are these to you?" He answered, "The children of whom God has graciously given your servant." Then the handmaids came forward, they and their children, and they bowed down. Leah too came forward with her children, and they bowed down. And afterwards Joseph and Rachel came forward and bowed down. And he asked, "What did you intend by that whole camp that I met?" He answered, "To gain favor in my Lord's eyes." Esau said, "I have plenty. My brother, let what you have remain yours." But Jacob said, "No, I beg of you, if I have now found favor in your eyes, then accept my tribute from me, inasmuch as I have seen your face, which is like seeing the face of the divine, and you were appeased by me. Please accept my gift, which was brought to you, inasmuch as God has been gracious to me, and as much as I have everything." He urged him, and he accepted. They said, "Travel on and let us go. I will proceed alongside you." But Jacob said, "My Lord knows the children are tender. The nursing flocks, the cattle are upon me. If they be driven hard for a single day, then all the flocks will die. Let my Lord go ahead of his servant. I will make my way at my slow pace, according to the gate of the drove before me and the gate of the children, until I come to my Lord at Seir." Then Esau said, "Let me assign to you some of the people who are with me." And he said, "To what purpose? Let me just have favor in my Lord's eyes." So Esau started back that day on his way to Seir. And Jacob journeyed to Sukkot and built himself a house. And for his livestock, he made shelters. He therefore called the name of that place Sukkot. Jacob arrived whole at the city of Shechem, which is the land of Canaan, upon his arriving from Paddan Aram. And he encamped before the city. He bought the parcel of land upon which he pitched his tent, the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 kesets. He set up an altar there and proclaimed God, the God of Israel, as its name. Now, Dinah, the daughter of Leah, chapter 34, whom she had borne to Jacob, went out to look over the daughters of the land. Shechem, son of Hamor, the Hivite, prince of the region, saw her. He took her. He lay with her. He violated her. He became deeply attached to Dinah, daughter of Jacob. He loved the maiden and appealed to the maiden's emotions. So Shechem spoke to Hamor, his father, saying, "Take me this girl for a wife." Now Jacob heard that he had defiled his daughter Dinah, while his sons were with his cattle in the field. So Jacob kept silent until their arrival. Hamor, Shechem's father, went out to Jacob to speak to him. Jacob's sons arrived from the field, and when they heard, the men were distressed. They were fired deeply with indignation, for he had committed an outrage in Israel by lying with the daughter of Jacob. Such a thing may not be done. Hamor spoke with them, saying, "Shechem, my son, longs deeply for your daughter. Please give her to him as wife, and intermarry with us. Give us your daughters to us, and take our daughters for yourselves. And among us you shall dwell. The land will be before you. Settle and trade in it, and acquire property in it." Then Shechem said to her father and brothers, "Let me gain favor in your eyes, and whatever you tell me I will give. Inflate exceedingly upon me the marriage settlement and gifts, and I will give whatever you tell me. Only give me the maiden for a wife." Jacob's sons answered Shechem and his father Hamor cleverly, and they spoke because he had defiled their sister. They said to them, "We cannot do this thing, to give our sister to a man who is uncircumcised, for that is a disgrace to us. Only on this condition will we acquiesce to you. If you become like us, by letting every male among you become circumcised, then we will give our daughters to you, and take your daughters to ourselves. We will dwell with you and become a single people. But if you will not listen to us to be circumcised, we will take our daughter and go." Their proposal seemed good in the view of Hamor and the view of Shechem, Hamor's son. The youth did not delay doing the thing, for he wanted Jacob's daughter. Now he was the most respected of all his father's household. Hamor, with his son Shechem, came to the gate of the city and spoke to the people of the city, saying, "These people are peaceable with us. Let them settle in the land and trade in it. For see, there is ample room in the land for them. Let us take their daughters for ourselves as wives and give our daughters to them. Only on this condition will the people acquiesce with us to dwell with us to become a single people, that all our males become circumcised as they themselves are circumcised. Their livestock, their possessions, and all their animals, will they not be ours? Only let us acquiesce to them, and they will settle with us." All the people who depart through the gate of the city listened to Hamor and his son Shechem, and all the males, all those who depart through the gate of the city, were circumcised. It came to pass on the third day, when they were in pain, that two of Jacob's sons, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, each took his sword. They came upon the city confidently and killed every male. And Hamor and Shechem his son they killed at the point of the sword. They took Dinah from Shechem's house and left. The sons of Jacob came upon the slain, and they plundered the city which had defiled their sister, their flocks, their cattle, their donkey, whatever was in the town and whatever was in the field they took. All their wealth, all their children and wives they took captive, and they plundered as well as everything in the house. Jacob said to Simeon and to Levi, "You have discomposed me, making me odious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanite and among the Perizzite. I am few in number, and should they band together and attack me, I will be annihilated, I and my household." They said, "Should he treat our sister like a harlot?" Chapter 35. God said to Jacob, "Arise, go up to Bethel and dwell there, and make an altar there to God, who appeared to you when you fled from Esau, your brother." So Jacob and his household and all who were with him discarded the alien gods. Jacob said to his household and all that with him, "Discard the alien gods that are in your midst. Cleanse yourselves and change your clothes. Then come, let us go up to Bethel. I will make there an altar to God, who answered me in my time of distress, and was with me on the road that I traveled." So they gave to Jacob all the alien gods that were in their possession, as well as the rings that were on their ears, and Jacob buried them under the terebinth tree near Shechem. They set out, and there fell a godly terror on the cities which were around them. So they did not pursue Jacob's sons. Thus Jacob came to Luz in the land of Canaan. It is Bethel. He and all the people who were with him. He built an altar there and called the place El Bethel, for it was there that God had been revealed to him during his flight from his brother. Deborah, the nurse Rebecca, died. She was buried below Bethel, below the plateau. He named it Alon Bakut. God appeared to Jacob again when he came from Paddan Aram and blessed him. And God said to him, "Your name is Jacob. Your name shall not always be called Jacob, but Israel shall be your name." Thus he called his name Israel. And God said to him, "I am El Shaddai. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a congregation of nations shall descend from you. Kings shall issue from your loins. The land that I give to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, I will give to you. And to your offspring after you, I will give the land." Then God ascended from upon him in the place where he had spoken with him. Jacob had set up a pillar at the place where God had spoken with him, a pillar of stone. He poured a libation upon it, poured oil upon it. Then Jacob called the name of the place where God had spoken with him, Bethel. They journeyed from Bethel, and there was still a stretch of the land to go to Ephrath, when Rachel went into labor and had difficulty in her childbirth. And it was when she had difficulty in her labor, the midwife said to her, "Have no fear, for this one too is a son for you." It came to pass, as her soul was departing, for she died, that she called his name Ben-Oni. But his father called him Ben-Yamin. Thus Rachel died, and was buried on the road to Ephrath, which is Bethlehem. Jacob set up a monument over her grave. It is the monument of Rachel's grave until this day. Israel journeyed on and pitched his tent beyond Migdal-Edir. And it came to pass, while Israel dwelt in the land, that Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel heard of it. The sons of Jacob were 12. The sons of Leah, Jacob's firstborn, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. The sons of Rachel were Joseph and Benjamin. The sons of Bilhah, the maidservant of Rachel, was Dan and Naphtali. The sons of Zilpah, maidservant of Leah, was Gad and Asher. These are the sons of Jacob, who were born to him in Paddan Aram. Jacob came to Isaac, his father, at Mamre, Kiriath Arba, that is, Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac sojourned. Isaac's days were 180 years, and Isaac expired and died. He was gathered to his people, old and fulfilled of days. His son Esau and Jacob buried him. Chapter 36. And these are the descendants of Esau. He is Edom. Esau had taken his wives from among the Canaanite women: Adah, daughter of Elon, the Hittite, and Olibamah, daughter of Anah, the daughter of Zibeon, the Hivite, and Basmat, daughter of Ishmael, sister of Nebot. Adah bore Esau Ilphaz, Basmat bore Reuel, and Olibamah bore Jeush, Yalam, and Korah. These are Esau's sons who were born to him in the land of Canaan. Esau took his wives, his sons, his daughters, and all the members of his household, and his livestock, and all the animals, all the wealth he had acquired in the land of Canaan, and went to a land because of his brother Jacob. For their wealth was too abundant for them to dwell together, and the land of their sojourns could not support them because of their livestock. So Esau settled on Mount Seir. Esau, he is Edom. These are the descendants of Esau, ancestor of Edom, on Mount Seir. These are the names of Esau's sons: Elphaz, son of Adah, Esau's wife; Reuel, son of Basmat, Esau's wife. The sons of Elphaz were Timon, Omar, Zippo, Gatam, Kenaz, and Timnah. And Timnah was a concubine of Elphaz, son of Esau, and she bore Amalek to Elphaz. These are the names of Adah, Esau's, the children of Adah, Esau's wife. These are the sons of Reuel: Nahat, Zerah, Shema, Mizah. These are the children of Basmat, Esau's wife. And these are the sons of Olibamah, daughter of Anah, daughter of Zibon, Esau's wife. She bore Esau Yeush, Yalam, and Korah. These the chiefs of the children of Esau. The descendants of Esau's firstborn Eliphaz was chief Teman, chief Omar, chief Zippor, chief Kenaz, chief Korah, chief Gatam, chief Amalek. These the chiefs of Eliphaz in the land of Edom. These the descendants of Adah. And these the descendants of Reuel, Esau's son, chief Nahat, chief Zerah, chief Shema, chief Mizah. These the chiefs of Reuel in the land of Edom. These the descendants of Basmath, Esau's wife. And these the descendants of Olibama, Esau's wife, and chief Yeush, chief Lelam, Jalam, chief Korah. These are chiefs of Olibama, daughter of Anna, Esau's wife. These are the children of Esau, and these are the chiefs. He is Edom. These are the sons of Sarah, the Horite, who dwelled and settled in the land, Lotan, Shobal, and Zibon, and Anna. Dishon, Ezir, Dishan. These are the chiefs of the Horite, the descendants of Seir in the land of Edom. The sons of Lotan were Hori, Haman. Lotan's sister was Timnah. These are the sons of Shobal, Alvan, Mahala, Abal, Shifo, Onam. These are the sons of Zibiah, Aye, Anna, the name Anna, the same Anna who discovered the mules in the desert while he was pasturing the donkeys for Zibon his father. These are children of Anna, Dishon, Olibama, daughter of Anna. These are sons of Dishan, Hemdan, Eshban, Ithran, Haran. These are sons of Ezir, Bilhan, Zavan, Akan. The sons of Dishan, Uz, Aran. These are sons of Horite, the chiefs of the Horite, Chief Otan, Chief Shobal, Chief Shibion, Chief Anna, Chief Dishon, Chief Ezir, Chief Dishan. These are the chiefs of the Horite, according to the chiefs in the land of Seir. These are the kings who reigned in the land of Edom before a king reigned over the children of Israel. Bela, son of Beor, reigned in Edom. The name of his city was Dinhabal. And Bela died. And Joab, son of Zerah, from Bozrah, reigned after him. And Joab died. Husham, the son of Timnites, reigned after him. And Husham died. Hadad, son of Bedad, who defeated the Midianites in the field of Moab, reigned after him. The name of his city was Avit. And Hadad died. And Samla of Masreka reigned after him. Samla died, and Saul of Rehoboth Nahar reigned after him, and Saul died. Baal Hanan, son of Hor, reigned after him. Baal Hanan, son of Hor, died, and Hadar reigned after him. The name of his city was Paul. His wife's name was Mehetabel, daughter of Matred, daughter of Mizahab. These are the names of chiefs of Esau by their families, by their regions, by their names, the chiefs of Timnah, the chiefs of Alva, the chief Yethet, the chief Olibama, chief of Elah, chief of Pinon, chief of Kenaz, chief of Timnan, chief of Mibzar, chief of Magdil, chief of Iram. These are the chiefs of Edom by their settlements in the land of their possession. He is Esau, father of Edom. Yeah, no, okay, that's a lot of names. That's crazy. Yeah. Let's read that one more time, shall we? a lot of names. All right. Before we get started, obviously this is a continuation of the story which Jeff was covering last week on Jacob's return from Laban back to his home country, back to Israel, where he's from. Or not, Israel isn't officially what it's titled yet. It's Canaan still, but it will become Israel later. So this is a continuation of his story and how he returns. There's a lot of stories in this section, obviously the different parts of it, as far as how he meets with Esau, how he deals with Shechem, and different sub-stories within side of it, and of course, obviously the death of Rachel and birth of his son Benjamin. There's also for lack of a better word, hidden stories with inside the story, as far as the Bible is written in a particular way to give us more information than what the current story says by just rereading the story with a different mindset. You get more information out of it. We'll discuss that a bit today. We'll be discussing only two of them. There were four that I found. There's only two we'll discuss today. I don't have time to cover all four of them. So there's extra stories inside here that we'll be able to explain what these stories are actually talking about. We'll get to that later. Before we get to these details, any questions, comments, or things I can answer for you that caught your attention about this section? Yes, Louise.
About Jacob wrestling with the angel, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And with all the pronouns, I always get mixed up about who's telling who, I will not let you go until you bless me.
Yeah, Jacob's is talking to the angel at that time to identify the pronouns to who's doing what. Hebrew used the word et to identify who's doing what to whom. So in our language, you say, okay, so-and-so spoke to this person. We know this first person spoke to the second person, because that's how our linguistic studies works. He doesn't work that way. It's so-and-so spoke and this person. It doesn't say who spoke to who. Well, the et identifies which one did what. So in Hebrew, we don't have a translated word for et. We can't use it. It's an assignment, not a word we transfer. So it is Jacob asking the person he's wrestling with, the angel or spirit, to bless him. Yes.
When they're doing genealogy
of Esau.
Yeah. Of Esau, it goes, how come it goes, Esau, who is known as Edom, Esau, who is known as Edom, Esau, the father of Edom.
Yeah, as far as why it identifies him as Edom, and then father of Edom. Back in the story when Esau and Jacob were having their issues early on, when he wanted the red stew, that's when Esau got his name as red, Edom. That's where he got his name from. Or it's not really a name, it's more of a title or a designation. That's a nickname. It's a good way for it, a nickname. So he is Edom. The point of chapter 36 is it was discussing all the different genealogies. And note, there's more than just his family in there, if you caught that. There's a Horite family and his family both listed in that chapter. The reason is all of Esau's sons intermarried with the Horites, and that's why they're all intermingled together, why the chapter covers both family lines. So identify who's who and where these people come from, and they all become one family. So chapter 36 is pointing out that the Horites and Edomites melded into a single group as one body. So a very large tribe afterward. But the discussing as far as where they all came from, where they all went to, it points out in chapter 36, it says chief is this, chief that, chief. That means head of his clan, which means each one of those names represents a whole family group that they descended and became as they grew and expanded in their children and grandchildren and whatnot. At the tail end of 36, it also talks about regions, like areas, cities, and as far as the chief of this area, this group of people, which means these individual families, which comprise the Edom, we call it Saudi Arabia today, and plus Yemen and Oman and other parts there along that general area in the Middle East. That's their general territory. All of them grew and they became their own nation states in their own little subcategories. We run across a few of them later on. Midian, for example, is not listed here as a descendant, but he's from Abraham. But Amalek is mentioned here. Now, if you recall later on when Moses brings people out of Egypt, what one country attacks them on the backside? Amalek. And what does God say? Wipe them out. Kill them off. Because they were so evil in what they chose to do. Now, it takes many, many years. It's like 400 some odd years, 480 thereabouts, give or take, before Saul is given the assignment, all right, the time of Amalek has now come to an end. Take him out. And of course, Saul fails. Oh, well. No big shock. But he tried. I'll give him credit. He tried. So Amalek is one of Esau's descendants, and Esau, over time, has always been a thorn, so to speak, in Jacob's side as time went on. But we'll discuss that as the more the Torah is read and each individual tribe comes along and they do their thing. Some of these kings' names, I'll draw a map real quick if you don't mind. Where'd my markers go? Here's one. This is not a detailed map. It's general representation, right? So I have bigger city. General shape of Israel, right? Abraham and Isaac all hung around Hebron. That's the general territory where they hung out. That's where Esau grew up, where Jacob grew up. They all grew up in this generalized territory. Shechem, by the way, which we read this part of the story, is way up here. Close to that spot. So this is where they all grew up. When Abraham divided Ishmael and Isaac and said, okay, Ishmael, go away. Ishmael grew up and he became his own people, but he headed east. So he started to populate. He wasn't a huge population yet. He was still growing and was expanding as his sons grew and they had children and such and such. He grew up in just a generalized area where the mountain region was starting up on the other side of the Jordan River and the Dead Sea. Well, he obviously has kids and Esau marries one of his daughters. Well, later on, when Jacob's coming back from Padan Aram, which is way, this off my map, technically. It's like way up here above the words Genesis, where he was hanging out. We'll just put a representation of this little circle. Pretend that's a Padan Aram. So the area where Abraham came from, where Rebekah comes from, they're descendants. When Jacob was traveling from here down, he obviously stops along the way in a few different cities, traveling eventually to get into Hebron. Before he gets here, Esau meets him along with the storylines from Mount Seir, the Seir region. Well, that same area that Ishmael went to as well. So Esau and all of his property went to the hill country. The hill country starts along here, but continues and expands further south. That's where it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. That's where we get, what are those two cities today? It's Mecca and Medina. They're down in this territory down there in that generalized area. That's where Edom and Ishmael too expanded. But not all of them did, because Amalek, one of Esau's sons, doesn't go down that direction. He actually hangs out in the southern area of Israel itself. That's where his general, you know, life expense area was. So Amalek goes this down this generalized area. Edom takes over that area. Of course, obviously, they wind up expanding as time goes on and take over large swaths of land. Midian gets mixed in there, too, and, of course, gets wiped out later on. But they all head east and south. Generally, as opposed to Lot's kids, which headed just straight east. Because Moab and Ammon, Lot's two sons through his daughters, they took over these generalized areas. Does that make sense for who went where? Note, they all went that way, out of Canaan. Why? They get kicked out, they got sent there, but dominantly, God said, this is my land, I choose who it goes to. And it doesn't go to any of you. All of you, get out. And so through series of events, their lives, whatever it may be, God made sure they all got out. And that's where they all went. This area was designated for God's descendants to, or descendants, but God's children, I mean those who followed him, to be inheritors of this territory, which of course Israel takes over after coming out of the Exodus many, many years later. Hopefully there's questions as far as where they're going and how they expanded. Any questions so far I can talk to you about before I go into my little spiel? We're going to take a break by about 15 minutes to turn the furnace on because I'm cold. Just to give you a heads up on that. Any comments or questions so far? Yes.
In 35:11, when God's blessing Jacob and telling him he'll become a nation and a multitude of nations, or I think you had a different word in there.
See here. It says... you named the Jacob. Okay. I'm El Shaddai, before you multiply, a nation and a congregation of nations shall descend from you. The king shall issue from your loins. It's a congregation of nations.
Is that just, I've got it as a multitude of nations. Is that saying that more than one nation came from Jacob?
It's more than one nation. Okay. So it's truly what it means. We commonly think of like Jacob, the father of all of Israel, right? All the 12 tribes. Well, that's sort of, that's true in a very narrow sense that the 12 tribes came out of Egypt. They populated this area. And of course, eventually it divides in half with northern tribe, southern tribe, right? Well, these people don't stay here. Because Nebuchadnezzar shows up, they're the Assyrians, the Babylonians, they capture and carry them all away. Well, what happens to these people? Well, God doesn't wipe them all out. They move on to other areas of the world and repopulate other areas of the world, not just these two areas. And in fact, in most documentations point out there are dominant populations throughout the world of certain countries of descendants of these generalized people. So the practice by which, I think it was the Babylonians that did it, Syrians did it too, I think it was Babylonians that did it first, was to, if I come over as Babylonians many, many years later after, after the kings have come and they've done their messed upness in part of northern Israel, the Nebuchadnezzar comes over, as well as others do, take over chunks of populations and carry them. So in Babylonian and Assyrian philosophy was that I can take over a country and leave a few, you know, soldiers around and go home, but the country eventually will rebel. How do I prevent the country from rebelling? Simple. I will take out large chunks of population and move them way over somewhere unrelated. At the same time, I will take populations from these other areas, I'll call little X's, and carry them over and repopulate that territory with these other unrelated, biologically, people. That's where we get the term of the Samaritan. You know, the Good Samaritan story with Messiah when he's around. That's where it comes from, is that they were Samaritans. They weren't biologically Israel at all. No physical relation, no nothing. They were from other peoples, from other cultures, other groups, other gods, other religions, who came from where they were being picked up from by the Assyrian and the Babylonian empires and brought over here to repopulate. That's where they got this whole funky mix of weird stuff happening inside this territory. And that was their methodology. But it's counterproductive in some ways. One, your population gets all spread out too thin. You can't balance or keep it under control anymore. But the other is that these people groups who you've moved, there's no law says they can't move again. They were allowed to move again. They didn't come back, but they moved again. They moved, most of them, according to the migration patterns and the gravestones they found, all headed north into what we would consider modern day, the southern parts of Russia, and their gravestones match, and the Hebrew letters are chiseled out on the gravestone still, match, and they traveled over into Europe. Around, they reached Europe about the time the Roman Empire was starting its growth, as you can call it. Roughly about 200 or so BC, Roman Empire was actually starting, you know, gain traction and get some power. These people groups had circled and went around Greece with the Greek Empire and worked their way through the mountainous regions over into Europe. That's where they wound up, most wound up being. At the time they got there, their gravestones stopped resembling, you know, Hebrew letters and started resembling some other kind of language, and it kind of mingled as they had met other cultures and changed their languages. But that's the way I'm going. So this whole population becomes many, many nations over a long period of time. Does that make sense? Any other questions? Oh, yes, Jeff.
Yeah, and it's quite interesting that the two major forces that ended up taking down the Roman Empire later were Parthia, which is where a lot of them went, and the Germanic tribes, which is where the other part
exactly. Most of these tribes, which is, it's funny, as they're coming along many years, a thousand years go by, something like that, these two people groups that the Israelites were repopulated to, the areas they went to, and where they migrated to, those areas became the big powers of the world and wiped up, he's correct, taking down the Roman Empire many, many years later. It's kind of funny, things go full circle sometimes, how God manipulates and moves people around. Yes?
So does that mean then the Edomites, they were the ones that took down the Roman Empire?
No. Sorry, I was referring to the Israelite, the northern tribe people groups that did most of that. Edom stayed south and got wiped out defeated and taken over many times, but they never became a world power, so to speak. They became really strong. They stayed where they were at for the most part. They got taken, the Syrians took them, did Greece go that far south? I can't remember if Greece went that far south or not. I don't think they did. They went to Egypt, they didn't go farther south than that. So, I know Rome did take them, and so did the Syrians took them, but that was about it. Edom never really did, great power, strengths. Okay, totally off topics. Any other questions? That's all right. It's all your fault. All right, let's get started. I have 10 minutes before I give you your break. I'm going to erase my map because I don't need this map. I'm going to draw you other stuff. But I lost my eraser. My little girl was playing with it. I'm sure she probably had this work. She was playing with it when I got here, and you know, she's, you know, a year and a half, and I'm sure she wandered away and had fun.
Making excuses for
her. Yes, I'm making excuses for her. Blame the kid. All right. So, at this time, in the first part of Genesis chapter 34, sorry, 32, verse 4, Jacob's starting to return. Now, mind you, Jacob's gone for about 20 years, roughly. About 20 years from when he left and took off from Israel, from his mom, and from his brother. He's gone about 20 years, he comes back. It could be 21 years, but it's about 20. So that means his oldest son is 12. So Reuben's 12, and Joseph is about 5 years old, roughly. He could be close to 6, but somewhere in that ballpark of 5 to 6 years old. Joseph is the youngest, and Reuben's the oldest of all 11 sons plus one daughter, so 12 children. So they're all combined together between 12 and 5. And Jacob's a little over 60 years old when he's traveling back to his hometown. His first encounter with his brother. Now, mind you, he was originally sent out by his mom, Rebecca, and she told him when Esau cools down with this finagling we've been going on with the blessings and such, I'll send for you. She never sent for him. 20 years later, she never sent for him. Did he ever cool down? You'd have to say no, he didn't, if she never sent for him. Because she would have notified him, hey, Esau's no longer angry, come on back. But she never did that. God is the one who had to send him back. So she knew Esau was still angry. And Jacob would have gotten the impression, he'd never got a message from his mom that Esau wasn't mad anymore. Jacob would assume Esau's still angry. So what's Jacob going to expect to see when he runs into his brother again? Yeah, going to get killed. Because Esau said, I will kill you once the mourning of our father has ended. Now note, their father was Isaac, and Isaac isn't dead yet. Isaac doesn't die for a long time. He's just blind. He's old. He's blind. But he's not dead. He's just old and blind. So Esau does not have the opportunity to kill Jacob yet, but Esau still isn't pleased with him. So Jacob, of course, comes. He sends messengers out saying, hey, Esau, I'm here. Note, you meet your enemy first, I guess, before you meet your parents. I have been blessed. I've been a sojourner for Laban. I want to point out something to you real quick, is that in verse 5, it says, I have been a sojourner with Laban. There's a reason why you use the term sojourner, I've been living with, meaning I've been dominant of. Jacob is pointing out in that phrase that I am not a king. I am not a territory owner. I have been a stranger in someone else's home. It's important because Esau, that's not the case. Esau owns territory, owns property, owns lots of stuff. And so Esau can see with that one phrase that God did, as far as Esau's mind, God did not bless Jacob like he blessed Esau. Esau was blessed greater. See all these possessions I have. It's a way of buttering up your enemy, pointing out that, hey, look at all things that you have versus what I have. You have far more. So God, obviously, the blessings, the feud we had over who got what blessing, who got what firstborn, blah, 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 didn't pan out to anything. So don't worry about it. It's a way of relaxing his brother a little bit. Of course, what was Esau's response? 400 men. Why 400 men? What should that tell you? Anybody recall that story? What happened many years earlier with Abraham? When Abraham went to war against 5 kings, what did he do? He had 400 men with him. So do you go with 400 men for a party? Yeah, to make peace. Oh, hi, how's it going? Good to see you, brother. What would you go with 400 men for? Well, Jacob would have known his own grandfather's military history. He knew his grandfather. He knew Abraham. They were alive. They were teenagers, Abraham, before Abraham died. So they were around. They knew the story. So he would have known, if you're coming with 400 men, you're not coming here to give me a high five. Say, good job. You know, wonderful, nice time. You're coming here for war. That's the point. So we're learning about what's Jacob expecting. He's expecting a war. Now, of course, is Jacob a warrior? No. What is Jacob's response? Two camps. This is a big player in after our break. Two camps. This is an important event. Because it means something. Two camps is a huge deal in this story. So don't forget it. We'll come back to that. We come in two camps. So he figured if he strikes one camp, the other may flee. the first one may escape. The goal, of course, one of them escapes and one of them gets slaughtered or attacked, and he could hopefully would at least half this company, half his people would survive. This is a symbolic event of the two camps. That's why we're going to mention that now in a few minutes from now later on when it comes up again. What's Jacob's then response? What's he decide to do? After he splits himself in two camps, what's he wind up doing? Says gifts, droves of, you know, this flock and that flock. I'm not going to go into what the animals mean, the symbolism between each one of them. That's beyond the scope of today's discussion. But they mean certain things. Not all of them, but certain ones do. What is Jacob's response to God? He prays. He's asking for help. Now, God had told Jacob, I will bring you back here safely. This is when Jacob had left his brother and his dad. They took off, and he went to Bethel. He saw this vision of the ladder going up and down. Angels going up and down the staircase, and God was above. And Jacob said, if you bring me back safely, I'll worship you and be my God forever. Jacob's not made it back to that same town yet. He'd be his brother first. Wise choice. Because God has to agree to bring you back to Bethel, which means Jacob knows, God, if I don't make it back, that's your fault. I'm going to go see Esau now, because this is my biggest risk. If I make it back to Bethel first and then go see Esau, I can't say, God, you screwed up. It's all on me. But if I make it to Esau first before I go to Bethel, it's all in your hands, Father. It's a great strategy that Jacob's using. He's a smart man. God's answer is brilliant. We'll discuss that. So, of course, first of all, Jacob's praying to God. He's desiring or wanting an answer. Jacob's methodology, which God speaks to him, is through visions and dreams. That's how he communicates. This is not a I talk to you conversational event like he does with Moses or even with Abraham, for that matter. Abraham did some conversational events. Jacob's mostly with the dream aspect. We use that term dreams because that's mostly how the story we get from Jacob, and when God speaks to him, he's sleeping, or one of those lines is happening to him. In this case, Jacob takes a nap. All of his family, of course, is there. He takes a nap, he takes a sleep. He's expecting, of course, God to respond, to answer his prayers. And what's God's answer? Nothing. Silence. It says, verse 14, he spent the night there. He took for that which he had hit from his hand in tribute to his brother and 200 she-goats. All this, he was reminding God, hey, you promised you'll do good to me. So he spent the night there. He would expect an answer as he normally gets. He didn't get one. Because God wasn't going to answer Jacob in this fashion this time. He was choosing a different method to answer him, which is where our first hidden story is today. In this section, he spent the night there. Of course, does all of his various tributes and such. We're going to discuss all the different animals, the different categories of what he sends out, and as far as how they are to address Jacob. It's the angel that comes. So this is God's answer. Verse 23 of chapter 32. He got up that night. This is the following night after he had spent the night, after he'd had his prayer. Took his two wives, his two handmaids, 11 sons, across a ford of Jabbok, and when he took them, he had crossed over and had them cross over the stream. He sent over his possessions. Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the break of dawn. When he could not overcome him, he struck the socket of his hip. Jacob's hip was dislocated as he wrestled with him. He said, "Let me go, for dawn is broken." This angel is doing something. This is his answer. I'm going to change colors. So the angel, or the spirit, messenger, what do you call it? The angel is the answer. That's a strange answer, isn't it? God, save me. Okay, I'm going to beat you up. All right, who wants that answer, right? Hey, Dad, I need help. Here, I'll smack you around a bit. We're all good. That's what he's doing, right? God's sending an angel to beat up Jacob. Now, an angel, okay, they have the power of God with them. He could just strike Jacob dead. That wasn't the point. But it wasn't the angel to kill Jacob. It was to beat him up for a while. Because the angel's doing something to him. So the angel, or that spirit, whatever you want to call it, is literally beating him up. But in this beating up process, does the angel prevail? Does he win? No. He doesn't win. He has to, mind you, cheat. Because at the time of the wrestling, you have the angel essentially appears to be equally matched or designed to be equally matched to be like Jacob's competitor. So Jacob is wrestling with someone who is equivalent to himself. The angel can't win. So what's he do? He touches the socket. Now, if I touch your socket, you didn't sprawl the floor and your socket didn't pop out, right? Well, if an angel touches your socket, what might happen? Something different than what would be than when I would happen. So the angel essentially cheats in order to, a different color, but blue didn't work out well. The angel winds up dislocating his hip socket. Again, is that the right answer? Is that a funny answer? A strange answer? God help me. Here, I'll dislocate your socket for you. Now you limp for the rest of your life. Enjoy. Is that the kind of answer you'd expect to see from God? Of course not. You're supposed to be men who believe and trust and follow him. Are they expecting it beat up? No, they're not expecting it. Yes, Anne.
No, we're not expecting it, but in our weakness, God can be strong.
God can be strong in our weaknesses. And this weakness that Jacob has in this instance is a fascinating one. Because it's teaching us something about God's answer in this story. Yes.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, he's on his way to meet his brother, whom he believes is going to kill him. In front of him, he's presenting all these gifts, hoping to soften him up. Downplaying who he is. You know, I'm just this poor little sojourner, and I've accumulated this stuff through very hard work, but I'm going to give a lot to you because I'm your servant. And when he arrives, he's going to be beat up and limping. So it's like, it's kind of hard to beat up a guy that's already beat up.
That's true, too. Good point. It was God's strategy to avoid Esau from, you know, causing any kind of extra harm. Oh, wow, you're so badly shaped that I'll just leave you be. It's too humiliating. You know, beat up a man who's on the ground already bleeding. And it's possible that maybe God's primary objective just to make Esau not want to beat him up. There's actually a few stories about that. I point out one other possibility that could be. This angel is doing something. He's transferring authority. Because there's a symbol happening here. When God transfers a symbol from one to the next event, he uses word keys. In this word key story, what's he use? He uses one word key. Face. Face. He says it again and again in the story. God's face and man's face. It meant something. In this particular section, this is where our hidden story is jumping out at. In verse 21, it points out that, as you go through in this chapter, that he wants to appease Esau's angry face. I will see Esau's face and he will lift up my face. Those are the events that Jacob is after in this event of casting all these animals, trying to appease Esau's face. Now, in this story, when the angel beats him up, at the end of it, when the angel, of course, points out to him that you struggled with God and with man have prevailed, that's when Jacob realizes, I'm not dealing with a human, I'm dealing with a spirit. I've now seen God's face and I'm not dead. So he points out, Peniel, I've seen God's face and I have lived. So he reused the key phrase of face. He doesn't end there, though, because when he finally sees Esau, he points out, you take these gifts of all these animals, because seeing your face is like seeing the face of God. And you are happy with me. The key phrase in the storyline is the face. So God's transferring information. Let's discuss what he's transferring. Let's erase this real quick, because I don't need it right now. So panim, or face. Face, or pan. Panim is faces, but pan. His face. This face is a huge deal. Is anyone allowed to see the face of God, by the way, and live? No. So, anyone sees the face of God and dies. That's the rule. He sees the face of not only man, but also of God. And God's instruction, the Spirit's instruction was, you have prevailed.
your struggle with man and with God, you've prevailed. So in the seeing of faith, he prevails. Oops, ails. That's an I. He prevails in the seeing of the face and lives. So this is where we get our interesting storyline. In a normal story cycle, if you have repetitions in the Torah of phrases, in this case, seeing a face and living a face or being a face, over and over again, this particular story uses a face, that means this whole story from beginning to end is all one message. Find the message. And here's the message at, which will actually... I told you I'd give you a heater break. I'll give you a message real quick. I have to draw it, so it takes me a little while because I forgot to type it up last night when I was writing it out. Excuse me. I wrote it out here. This is a chiasmus. Or sorry, a chiastic. A chiasmus is the center. A chiastic structure. It's a Torah structure or a biblical structure that God uses as a literary story. What he does, he says, I'm going to repeat myself here and up here and down here and copy the statements over and over and over again until I get right in the middle. When I reach the middle where there's no copy, that's my message. And this is my answer to Jacob. So in this story, in verse 31, it says, I have seen God's face to face and live. So verse 31 of chapter 32 is, I see God's face. Now this, of course, is Jacob's the one who's seeing the face and he's lived. And of course, after the verse 31, it goes into verse 32. And it refers to the children of Israel, you can't eat the hip socket because he got dislocated, right? So the hip socket, or in particular, is referring to food, what you don't want or don't want to eat. Don't want or eat. Then, of course, it continues on to the next chapter of chapter 33, verse 1. It continues on, and Jacob raises his eyes. And what does he see? He sees Esau. And of course, his 400 men that are with him. So I'll put 400 up here. He's really thrilled about that, I'm sure. And continuing on, Jacob's response is to bow down 7 times. Right. It's bowed down 7 times. That's when Esau's response, of course, in verse, this bowed down 7 times, verse 3. Verse 4, Esau's response to the bowing down 7 times, the whole event, he comes and hugs him. Hugs, kisses, weeps. All this very, that's two E's. All these various things that he responds. This response is Jacob's answer in the storyline, which is what we're learning. At the end of verse 4 and verse 5, it starts backing up the story. It starts copying a mirror image of each other. Verse 5, we have the event of Esau, it says, raises his eyes. His eyes. He sees all the children. And he asks about all these animals and such, but he sees the children and sees them bowing. So these children, all these who are these, they also come bow down to him as they present, which is what Jacob did, bowing down. After bowing down, of course, Esau, and continue on in verse 9, I don't need this food. All the animals, I have plenty. Take it. I don't want it. It's not useful to me. The food or animals, oops, are not wanted. And of course, after that, he ends it, or he doesn't end it yet. He says, Jacob reiterates it in verse 10, I have seen your face. It's like the face of God. And you are pleased or appeased. In these storylines, we have copies of each other. The food and the animals and the faces, it winds up ending out in these cycles. As far as the bowing down here, Esau raising his eyes. Oh, sorry, bowing down and the food also. I got these lines incorrect, sorry. I'll redraw my lines. You have these two match, those two match. This one is the food wanted. Sorry. Raise eyes. Oh, I got bowels and eyes. I broke them down, didn't I? Sorry about that. This bow goes to there. The raised eyes there. The food want here, and then the face there. So we have the whole storyline of bowing down the eyes, and this whole storyline of raising the eyes and bowing down is one event there. So in this story, what we see, the most important part of the story, is the dead middle. So what's the point of the event of Esau's story? It's the center event that happens in these structures, they fan out. The center event is the message. It's Jacob's answer to the prayer. Jacob was praying to God. You said you'd get me back safely. You said I would be successful and all my children would be descendants of my generations to come, yada, yada, yada. I'm about to meet someone who's going to kill me. Save me, God. Where are you? Why aren't you doing your job? And God sends an angel and says, I've seen his face now and I've lived. You've struggled with man and with God and you will prevail. You have prevailed. But that doesn't tell Jacob what's going to happen. With this face event, the first part, when he sees the angel's face, is I've lived, I've seen face to face, and Jacob connects that event with seeing the angel's face to seeing his brother's face. He realized, God, the face I'm facing here, this angel and struggling and fighting, is Esau. It's the same person. Not by blood, not by flesh and blood, but spiritually they're the same event. This is my fight. This is the fight with Esau I'm having with this angel instead of on the battlefield the following day. I'm having it now with the angel. And I'm prevailing. As a result, that means when I see Esau, I'm also seeing God. Because when I'm seeing this angel, I'm seeing Esau. Then when I see Esau, I'm seeing God. That God is taking himself and placing him inside of Esau and taking Esau, placing himself as himself in these stories. He's connecting both of them together. God's answer to Jacob's prayer is Esau's response, which was he loved him. He wept over him. He kissed him. He received him as his brother. That was God's answer to Jacob's prayer. So God was using Esau to answer it for him. And God was battling Esau's battle with Jacob instead of having Esau battle it. It's a way of swapping stories. God does this many times throughout the story. We call it messianic figures. Someone who plays out a role that the Messiah is going to do later on. So God is playing out the role that Esau wants to do. But he's playing it out for him. And once he plays it out for him, now Esau is going to play out God's role, which is, I love you, my brother. Which means God's answer to Jacob is, Jacob, I love you. Yes, Anne.
Should we look at our enemies this way then, or what?
I don't look at my enemies, so I couldn't answer your question. I avoid enemies. Oh, sorry. Yes, Rose.
Well, I'd like to equate this to my own personal life. It's all down through my life. I have warred with my flesh. I have warred with God, if you will, because of my flesh. And my answer in my prayer would be that when I meet my Lord, he's going to greet me with a hug and a kiss and said, that pat on the head,
yeah,
well done, thy good and faithful servant.
Which is like what Esau's doing.
Yeah.
That's what Esau's doing. And God, by swapping this, and Jacob recognizing the swap, because Jacob had to realize the connection. He's went out and say, wait a minute, I'm seeing my brother, he's forgiving you, I'm seeing like God's face. So Jacob's the one who realized the angel he's fighting was seeing God's face, and now he's not fighting Esau, he realized, God, you took Esau's anger out of him. You took it upon, and I still had to pay for it in this wrestling match. But as a result, instead of Esau fighting me and probably killing me with his 400 men, instead of that fight being at that event when we meet, you're taking it away from Esau. You're taking it upon yourself to do it now, God. And as a result, God, you are putting your response and love of me into Esau instead. So my Esau becomes my God, my God becomes Esau. So it's a swap temporarily. It's not forever. It's just it's a symbol. So that's how the story's working, in that they're working together and God's taking figure swaps in order to get a message across to Jacob. Yes, Jacob, you are going to pay for what you did. However, I love you more. And you'll have a wound. You'll have a hip. You'll remember what happened. But this swap is important, Jacob. You and your family will live. You will continue on. This is the story. I'm going to stop for now. I'll give you a break. Go ahead, Dave.
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, at first, it's like, you know, he puts Leah and Rachel and the two maids in front. And then he puts, you know, the children and, I mean, he's in the back. He puts everybody in front.
No, he's not in the back.
He realizes it, and he comes forward and passes them all up, right?
He does it on purpose. Yeah, he goes in front of them on purpose. So he's setting them all up in their stage of one could argue importance or servants or whatever their position is in his family household. And then he puts himself in front of all of them. So he's the one in the very farthest front. Does that make sense?
Yes, I'm just curious of whether that was pre-planned all along, or was it that he realized at that point, and he went forward realizing that,
but
understanding the message from God and going, oh, it's okay, I'm safe, I can go up and look at Esau's face.
Sort of. I can't speak to the order of the event, so what that's supposed to be, as far as like which wife goes where, but the story of how he goes in front of them is our second hidden story. This second story is taking that picture, that imagery, and applying it to the holiday cycle that Jacob and his family are observing in this trek. I say that because we think, well, the holidays don't exist yet. They haven't been given the Torah yet. There's no atonement. There's no Passover. That's not even happened yet. Well, true, technically the events didn't happen, but God's a planner. He plans ahead of time. One of the things he planned, exactly. One of the things he planned is he planned on what holidays mean, and it's the meanings that he wanted us to understand. So I have it up here. You probably can't read it from wherever you're at. I'll read it out to you. I'll read it out loud. Now, first of all, this should sound familiar to any of you who have observed any of the holidays, because you've heard this story before, just with different words. So there are two camps. Jacob divides himself into two different separate camps, right? We talked about this before, we'll bring it up again now. He divides himself into two separate camps. There's a one camp on one side, one camp on the other. And what was his reasoning? His reasoning was, one will die so that the other will live. All right? Now, there's one holy day that uses that imagery. Not one dies, the other will live. They're two equal camps. It's atonement, the two goats. One dies, so the other one will live. It is Day of Atonement he's planning out in this two-camp division. He doesn't stop there. This gets very elaborate. Well, not very. It's mildly elaborate. So he does it. The division of two is to separate. He doesn't know which one will die, which one will live. But his goal is to divide them into two. One dies, one lives. Whichever one it is, he doesn't know. Now, following that event, the division, Jacob has to face God alone. This angel that fights them, he's all alone. Well, recall, in Days of Atonement, the priest is supposed to go before the throne of God completely alone. No one else is allowed to be there. So Jacob is playing out. That tells us, in this atonement imagery, Jacob is pretending or acting like the priest. So the priest, or Jacob, faces God alone. Priest. I'm not saying Jacob is a priest, although priests do come from him. The point is he's symbolically being this character. He must face God alone, just like the priest faces God alone. Now, in the story of atonement, if the priest is found unclean, what happens to him? He dies. So if the priest goes before God in his holy throne, he's got this, the Ark of Covenants there, the incense has been burning, and the priest is some corrupt woman-mongering evildoer. What's going to happen to him? God says, you're unclean. I'm striking you dead for entering my home. Get out. And you recall what happened to Aaron's two sons when they tried to offer a profane fire before God. Guess what happened to them? They got whacked. They're done. They're history. You don't offer, you don't go before God in an unworthy manner. You have to be clean, have to be ready for it. So Jacob faces God alone, and what is the angel's message? You struggle with God and you prevailed. That means you are clean. You are acceptable to God. That means I am receiving you, Jacob. Just like he would do to the priest, I will receive you. Now, when God has swapped himself with Esau in our previous imagery story, this finishes off our atonement imagery as well. It's a beautiful story how it does it. So when Jacob is now found worthy or found acceptable to this angel that's in front of him after this fight, of course, it happens, Jacob then presents his whole family to Esau. Now, in the priest, after he is found acceptable to God, he's supposed to present his whole family in the camp of the goats in particular, but also he's supposed to say over each of the goats, lay hands on, here's all the sins that he knows about. The people of Israel did this, and they did that, and this, and all these sins that the priest and his, mostly just priest, is supposed to lay on the hands of the goat that's going to die, or, no, the other goat. Which one, I forgot which one was going to, which one of them dies, one doesn't die. Whichever, he lays hands on one of them. They confess all the sins of the nation on this particular animal. And if it is accepted, means the priest is presenting all of Israel. In that process, presenting all of Israel, all the tribes, he's presenting all the descendancy, all the kings. Symbolically, he's going for God and saying, I am representation of all this whole massive nation right behind me, God. Though you can't see them because they're on the other side of the veil. I'm presenting them, and here are all the confessions of our sins of this goat. That's what you're supposed to be doing. That's the presentation process. And if it's accepted, God points out, you will be cleaned for atonement. So Jacob is presenting to Esau the same symbolism or same imagery that the high priest would present to God in that all of the people that you now see, Father, are before you. Well, Jacob's pointing to Esau, all the people you see now are my children. They are my descendants that God has blessed you with. Now, Jacob's response to Esau, when Esau says, hey, come with me or I'll send men with you, Jacob tells him no over and over again. That seems like a strange response. It isn't if you're looking at an atonement Passover, atonement holy day cycle. Because after this event, when Jacob presents his whole family or the goats are presented for God, God is supposed to cast lots to figure out which goat dies, which goat doesn't die. And God's the one who makes the decision. And the one that doesn't die, the one that's sent off the wilderness, who are they sent off with? Only one man goes with them. A holy priest of some form. No one else to go with them. They must remain alone by themselves as they carry this living goat out in the wilderness to wander off and whatever happens to him, who knows. The point is the symbol to remove the sins from your body, from your life, from your country, out of your nation, away from you. So Jacob, just like that goat, he has to face this or wander around alone. Just like the goat's supposed to wander around alone after presentation. Now, after this event, after they've wandered alone, so Esau is sent back to his place in Seir, and Jacob and their family are all left back with themselves and their own stuff. If this is accepted, the whole atonement process is accepted, the goats have been offered to God in the priestly form, if they've all been offered, the cycle has been happening, it has worked correctly, and God's accepted it all, then they all go to the next holiday, which is Sukkot. And what's Sukkot? Dwelling in temporary tents, the dwelling places. So in this process of the two camps and the division, one dies, one lives, was his reasoning, and he faced God alone just like a priest would do, Jacob was found worthy in God's eyes to be accepted, all those people were accepted. Jacob presents the entire family to Esau, but his family must be sent off into the wilderness alone, as if that goat is sent off in the wilderness alone. And after that, they then dwell in Sukkot. Sukkahs. They build a bunch of sukkahs. This symbolism between this atonement story, all the way down to, we'll get the last eighth day written here at the end, on the eighth day of Sukkot, or the Shemini Atzeret, the eighth day. This whole picture of this from here to here is atonement. Why would God want us to understand atonement in this imagery? What's the point of that? What's Jacob seeking? Exactly. He's seeking to be redeemed or reunited, to be at one, which we get the word atone, at one with his brother again. be at one with his heritage, with his family. So this whole process of atonement, the image we get from it, is the story that God's pointing out. Jacob's living the atonement cycle in this event with Esau. It is a result, when he's done with it, with the event, with this atonement story, he is then dwelling in Sukkot, or Sukkahs, as it points out toward the end of that particular chapter. Now, by the way, he dwells in Sukkahs, and then after he gets to Sukkahs, because he's dwelled in Sukkahs there, we're only supposed to dwell in Sukkahs for 7 days. I'm not saying this whole process took place in, like, you know, 7 days' time. The point is, it's symbolism alone. You dwell in Sukkahs for 7 days. At the end of Sukkot for 7 days, what's the eighth day? The eighth day is when you dwell with God. Now, of course, we've discussed this, that holy day time, that's representation of the holy day itself, representation of God dwelling here on earth and us with him and his whole massive kingdom, yada, yada, yada. That's the whole point of the eighth day in general. Well, Jacob does the same type of thing. When he builds, when he's done with his sukkah-ing, he goes over, he builds an altar. And what does he call the altar? God of Israel. I am now dwelling with God of Israel. So, symbolically speaking, Jacob fulfills atonement from the two camps all the way through Sukkot and all the way through the eighth day. He is now at peace. That's our second hidden story we're talking about today. And that God uses his imagery of the swapping of face to face to exchange himself with Esau. When he did that, it allows this story, this other hidden story of the sequence of events, to come to light. So we can see that because Esau is representing God, that means when Jacob presents himself to Esau, and Jacob's family is in the wilderness alone, meaning don't take Esau's men with you to travel you all the way out to Mount Seir, that this matches what would happen in atonement, that you would have Jacob to be the priest, present all of Israel to God, and of course, then they must cast off into the wilderness to not die, but to live in unprotected areas. That's the point of a wilderness, to live in unprotected location, whether it be in the woods or be in the desert, it's a wilderness. And what is the point of unprotected? Because when you're unprotected, what are you going to do? You're going to build a booth. You're going to build a sukkah. You're going to build a dwelling place. Which is the whole symbolism of what he did. It's exactly what he said he did. That's what he did. This is the second story. Any questions about how this holiday structure is built inside of this event? Did I lose you all? It's complicated, I get that. But when you build stories, and the way God builds stories, it's very interesting to know how he writes. Because he likes stories done in a particular way. He's not done yet, by the way. But this is how we're discussing the atonement process. Let's see here. I'll draw this up here as well. Alright, so after Jacob has built this altar, so he's called this altar the God of Israel. When this event takes place, if we understand the cycle of atonement, has Jacob seen his dad yet? No. He's still getting there. Has Jacob reached Bethel yet? No. He's still getting there. See, Jacob's not supposed to stop with this cycle. In this holy day cycle, we see that he's matched the atonement structure really well. And we give a brief view of Sukkot. Now, Sukkot, of course, is very expansive and detailed what the Torah and the Bible itself talks about, all the different symbolism built into Sukkot. We're not discussing all those today. But Jacob wasn't living out all of those symbols. He's mostly living out the section of atonement in particular, to be at one with his family again, which is the goal. Well, after he's done this cycle, he obviously does the eighth day, he does the God of Israel's work, the altar which he names it, which is of course symbolic of being with the God of Israel. He's not finished yet, because he hasn't seen his dad, he hasn't seen his mom, if she's still alive, but she might be. He hasn't seen any of his other family yet, he's just seen Esau. He's going to take a while getting there. After this section of atonement comes along, something else, the next cycle story, is hidden in here as well. I'm not going to go into great detail about it, but it's a story of the giving of the Ten Commandments. We'll talk about them just briefly next. Well, I'll leave that up there. New color. So after the story, what did he go after he's met this? He did his sukkah offering. Or sorry, he's built a sukkah. He did his altar offering. Where does he go from this point on? What's his next destination? Anybody recall? Shechem. Shechem. Remember, said that one out loud. And of course, that's where we get the story of Dinah and, you know, the brothers and the slaughtering of the Shechemites and blah 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 blah. Any questions about that particular section of the story? Because there's other things I want to cover instead of that one chapter, because there's other stuff in here. Because that story is pretty straightforward. You see, any questions about that? Because the continuation of Shechem, it's the tail end of Shechem's story, the actual slaughtering, that makes sense in this cycle. That's how we get to the giving of the Ten Commandments. Although he didn't give them yet, but it's symbolically he's giving them to. It's the destination he's going to. Shechem, what happens in Shechem? Shechem, of course, the man, the boy, or the youth, however old he is, he's the one who takes Dinah, Jacob's daughter. He kidnaps her, you know, takes her. She's now stuck in his home, castle, wherever he lives. And, of course, wants to take her as a wife. And, of course, her brothers, we know the story of the circumcision. Didn't work out so well for the Shechemites. And then the two brothers, Simeon and Levi, come and take Dinah back. They leave all the stuff. They just need it back. Their goal was just to get their sister back. The rest of the brothers come in and plunder the whole city. But the two brothers, their goal was to get Dinah back. They got the sister back, and of course, somebody else just plunders the city. Shechem, the boy, was said considered to be the most respected. Yes, that doesn't say much. Most respected of Hamor, the household of Hamor. Now, note, he's a kidnapper, he's a rapist, and he's the most respected. It tells you really poorly about the rest of the city if he's the most respected. And all of them agreed with him. Oh, yeah, you're the best. That's really bad. So the rest of the city wasn't worth much. But this event is an important symbol. Oh, yes, go ahead.
I was just curious, as far as most respected, could that be, could he be the favored son, as Joseph was kind of the favored son?
It can be interpreted as favored, most liked, most power. It can be interpreted either one. In this particular phrase, it's more commonly translated in Torah as respected, as opposed to the one in charge. Or the most, because he was not the one in charge. Hamor was the one in charge, his dad. But Shechem was, so it couldn't be, that's why they don't translate as the most powerful one, because it wouldn't make sense, because his dad was more powerful than Shechem was. But Shechem clearly was, he was bold enough to argue his own payment. If you recall that, when he's talking to Jacob, he said, hey, you pay anything you want. Inflate the price. I'll pay it. Whatever it is, I'll do it. He's bold enough to be able to do that, and obviously have the authority to do so. And Hamor just said, okay, what do you want, son? What do you want? Hamor bowed to Shechem's will in that case. Of course, it resulted in all their deaths, but you know they didn't know that. So he's the most respected. They all get slaughtered. I'll use a more pleasant term. They die. Because slaughtered sounds bad. They die in an unpleasant way. So in their death, what are they doing? What symbolically are the brothers doing to this black literature term, these wicked individuals? They are purging wickedness. Because it's something that's not to be done. It says, wait, this is not to be done in Israel. This cannot be done in Israel. So this death, they purged something, which is continued on in the tail end of the story. They purge wickedness. That wickedness, purging this, they got Shechem out, or sorry, they got Dinah out, and Shechem, of course, all this evilness dies. This purging process is where Jacob then kicks in again. Because, note, he was mostly silent during the death and the slaughtering of all of Dinah's people, or sorry, the Shechem's people. In the tail end, see, verse 35, chapter 35. God's response, so Jacob now sees, okay, I'm in Shechem, or outside the city skirts. I'm in Shechem, or near Shechem. I just slaughtered all these people. I only have my 12 sons, and, well, most of them are really young. Well, 12 sons left. I probably have a few servants too. But I don't have enough to fend off a military onslaught. But Jacob is now stuck in this now wasteland of a city. Note, the sons who came in and plundered it would have taken their gold, would have taken their silver, taken their whatever they valued. All the women they would have sold to slaves so they could get, you know, they'd sell them off because they don't need them. They may have taken wives, who knows. But they would have gotten rid of most people and sold them off and gotten, because you don't want to sit there and have, okay, here's 500 women I have to monitor. Okay, Naphtali, that's your job this week. Good luck. I was hair pulling up. I didn't find 500 people to manage. You would sell them off. That's mostly what they would sell off as slavery. But this purging process is important. This purging process, God's response to Jacob, now that you're obnoxious to the people around you, you're not acceptable to anybody else, move. Go to Bethel. And what was the purpose of Bethel? Dwell there. Make an altar to God who appeared to you, this is the first verse of chapter 35, when you fled from Esau, your brother. So, Jacob's response to all who were with him, discard the alien gods that are in your midst, cleanse yourselves and change your clothes. Then let's come to Bethel, I'll make there an altar to God who answered me in a time of distress and was with me on the road that I traveled. So they gave Jacob all the alien gods that were in the possession, as well as the rings that were on their ears. Jacob buried them underneath the terebinth tree near Shechem. This purging process wiped out the wicked individuals of Shechem. He didn't stop there. He wiped out the idol worship of his own family there also. This purging process didn't end with just killing a bunch of Shechemites. He wiped out the evilness that was inside his own family by cleansing them. So he purged the wicked people, but he also purged idolatry. Idols. I'm suspecting it's probably from the time he figured out that Rachel stole the idols from her dad. Just a guess. Because he's like, oh, where did these come from? I've seen these before. No comment. So this probably what happened. He probably figured out at that time that, or if he didn't know beforehand, that's what happened. But if you remember what was the rule that Jacob told Laban, if you find any idols with anyone amongst us, she's going to die. So when Jacob finds the idols, what happens? She dies. Watch what you say. Yes.
Well, I just found it interesting that, you know, the purge of the wickedness, and then like in Daniel 12:10, you know, it's a prophecy, and it uses the same words, purging the wickedness. You know, it says many will be purged, purified, and refined, but the wicked will act wickedly, and none of the wicked will understand, but those who have insight will understand.
Yep.
Kind of a nice parallel.
It is a parallel. That process of purging is an inner being type of thing. You have to start from the inside out. And this purging from the outside of Shechem, the death part, that is an outside a representation of what's inside of you. Now, Jacob, of course, is hanging out near Shechem, where there's evilness around him all the time. Because it's Shechem. And look, if the boy Shechem was the most respected and he was the rapist and kidnapper, the rest of them are probably pretty bad too, if not worse. So, he's hanging out with these guys, these women, men, mostly men. They're not pleasant areas to be around. It has to be cleansed, has to be cleaned up. God has already pointed out that the Canaanites are evil people. They're disgusting. He doesn't like them. So he wants them wiped out later anyway. But that's the process begins here. But Jacob realized, I think he realized, in my opinion, that this purging process of Shechem wasn't supposed to stop there. That was supposed to be the starting point of God and his relationship as God, as he returns to God. This whole story of returning to his family with atonement was between him and his family. But now he has to complete the process, complete the atonement process to God, not just to his family. So he got the first step part, but there's two parts to that. Atonement isn't just a one-on-one relationship with an individual person or even a congregation. It's with God in you. That's the true relationship you're after. Well, that can't be done until not just this presentation's clean, but you are clean on the inside. So this Dina event was a trigger that allowed the rest of the cleaning from the inside out to be done. And that included, unfortunately, the death of Rachel. That was part of the process. So this purging idol process results, of course, burying them all in Shechem. And he left the wicked idols and the wicked dead people, everything else, there at Shechem. Didn't bring them with you, you know, bury them on the road type of thing. He left them all there. That was important. He wanted to leave them behind. The purging idols also result in the death of Rachel. Also, one other lady died too. Who was that? You recall? Deborah. Now, there's lots of debate as far as why or how Deborah is even with Jacob at this time, because she should be with her, right? Well, it would have been her half-sister, most likely, with Rebecca, but we don't know how it is Deborah is there as well. But this death of Deborah, which, of course, she gets buried there at Bethel, where Deborah is buried. Oh, yes. All right, Anne.
Deborah was the midwife for Rachel. Then
she would have been Rebecca's maid. And if she was Rebecca's maid, there's lots of ways how she got from Rebecca and Isaac. Mind you, Deborah's going to be relatively old because Jacob is at least 60, probably 70. Actually, more likely because of his sons pulled this off. He's probably about mid 70s, maybe even 80 years old by now, which means Deborah, if she was with Rebecca when they left Laban's house, Laban's territory, she'd be about 120-ish years old, give or take. So she's relatively old this time. I don't know her exact age, but she's probably in the same ballpark or age as Jacob's mom, or near to it. So death of Deborah, death of Rachel, both these events happen. Deborah, of course, event happens at Bethel. And what happens to Rachel?
She dies in childbirth. Let's see, this happens after they leave Bethel. They're heading to Ephrath. They're heading down to eventually meet up with his dad down in Hebron territory.
Death of Rachel happens as well. So all these events, this purging process of the purging out the wickedness of Shechem, which obviously affects his own family, the purging out the idols also affected his family. It caused the death of people. It actually cleansed it out in this process. That's important. It meant something. If you will notice, Jacob, back to verse 35, Jacob's instructions about the idols, but and he also said, cleanse yourselves and change your clothes. Now, let's go back and recall, actually, go forward and recall, Moses, when he's about to receive the Ten Commandments, what does he tell the people? Wash yourselves, don't touch anything that's unclean, don't know your wives, because you're about to meet God, all on this mountain. Well, Jacob's about to take them to the mountain, the Bethel. He tells them, wash yourselves, change your clothes, you're about to meet God. In Jacob's mind, and at the time of Moses, this event of going to meet God at this altar at Bethel or at Mount Sinai is symbolic of the same type event for those two men. So in Moses' case, he was obviously going to be receiving the Ten Commandments. While in Jacob's case, he would receive God's blessing and instruction. What does that tell us? That tells us that Moses and Jacob are symbolically being the same type of man, the same type of messianic figure. Both of them responsible for cleaning their households. Moses, of course, all of Israel. Jacob, of course, all of his sons. And present themselves to God, and God's supposed to send the blessing. What is the blessing? Well, in Moses' case, it's the Ten Commandments. That is God's blessing. And in Jacob's case is, what he says, verse 10, your name Jacob is now called Israel. And I am El Shaddai, be fruitful, multiply a nation, congregation, nation should descend from you. This is all verse 10, 11, and 12. And kings shall issue from your loins, the land I give to Abraham, Isaac, I will give to you, your offspring, your afterward. Then God ascended from upon him in the place where he had spoken with him. The imagery we get from this storyline in this event when Jacob gets up to this Bethel mountain territory city, whatever you call it, lose its original name. He's receiving in the same imagery what Moses received. Moses received the Ten Commandments. We, you know, the chiseling, he breaks them later. The Ten Commandments. And Jacob received the blessing from God. That tells them those two events, symbolically, the Ten Commandments and the blessing of God are one and the same. And what were the Ten Commandments supposed to do? Well, this is how you're supposed to live, everybody. We live by this way. This is how you exist. If you don't buy these rules, it's not because the rules aren't there for you because they're rules, they're there for you to actually live successfully, as opposed to live unsuccessfully. That's the famous job, that's its function. Well, in Jacob's life, be blessed, be fruitful, multiply, a nation, I will give you all this wonderful stuff that I gave to your father, and that is your blessing.
meaning, Jacob, you will live. Moses' time, everybody, all of Israel, you'll live. Follow these instructions from Moses. Jacob, live. And you will obey as God originally told Abraham, that you and your sons will always teach your children to follow me. Follow me and you will live. They're both blessings of life. Yes, David.
Well, I was just kind of curious because when he wrestles with the angel tells him, you're no longer going to be Jacob. You're now going to be called Israel. And yep. Then here we are again.
Again, to name it again.
And it's God. And God's telling him the same thing, that yep. You are now Israel.
Yes, when you have two witnesses of something, it is confirmed. You have to have two witnesses. God is truly God telling you you're Israel. By the way, do you know what the word Israel means? No? It comes from two words, the is for you, the prince or a prince, an El of God. So, prince of God, meaning you are going to be God's prince. Well, who's the God's prince? Messiah. A prince means son of. So, Israel, you're being changed into this fashion. You're being renamed as this. So, when Jacob gets the message the second time, and note, even Joseph points out to Pharaoh, the two messages with the stalks of the wheat and the cows, the same message given twice, because confirmed there's two witnesses. Jacob's receiving two witnesses, just like Joseph had two witnesses. Pharaoh had two witnesses. Joseph just explained them to him. They're both supposed to be receiving the same instruction that God's pointing out to Jacob. This is confirmed. You are a prince of God. You are my son. Another way of wording it. Okay? Does that kind of make sense? So it's a confirmation of the original blessing that the man gave. Okay, so let's move forward a little bit. So in this process, we have this blessing, of course, has happened. You get this, I'm El Shaddai, yada, yada, yada. The purging process is completing in that Deborah dies there at Bethel. Now, what is symbolic of Deborah's death? Any guesses? Past is a big deal. Deborah represents where he came from. Represents Padan Aram. Because that's where she is and where she came from. Deborah represents the history that his family line, what she is from Laban and his father and grandfather, whatever, that whole family line, that's who she represents in this storyline. It's not too hard to understand. That's who she's supposed to represent. So the death of her ends his past connection to Padan Aram. I say that because recall, Abraham was allowed to go into Israel, the territory, Canaan territory, and go to Egypt he had to, go to everywhere else he needed to, but Isaac was told you're never allowed to leave. Jacob, however, was allowed to leave. He was allowed to go back to the past, go back to history, to Padan Aram. But now, once her death happens, in this purging process, the idols are now gone. Recall, the idols are not just the property of Canaan, it's also property of Padan Aram, where Laban came from, where Laban's at, where all that. They're all idol worshippers. The idols have to end. Your purging process means you are forever separated from your past. Forever. So as a result, the past has to die with you, or has to die at this time, or has to be some symbolic death of the past. The death of Deborah does a good job explaining that. It's reiterated also with, of course, the death of Rachel. Differently, though, but Rachel is, of course, fulfilling of the original prophecy that whoever finds the idols with this person shall surely die. The idols are now purged, therefore she's found, thus she'll surely die. In her death, though, is where the story takes a beautiful turn. I should find that eraser. I'm going to erase part up here, because I'm going to conclude with this part. I don't have time to cover all the rest of the details of the section, and I'm called you over, so I'm carrying you over too far anyway. Prince of God. Yeah, it comes to the word Sar and also El. So Sar, Prince of God. That's where the words come from. Some also argue it comes with struggle. I forgot the Hebrew for struggle. It's not quite spelled sufficiently enough to say they're the same word. They're really not. It's really designed for Sar, a prince. Same way you get the word Sarah from. It's designed for somebody who is an attachment or a one or at with God or like God. It also comes from, Ish, for the IS, for Ish, which man of God. All of it comes from the same generalized idea of prince or a descendant or a body, an embodiment or a descendant thereof God. Okay, so the death, these process, these purging process of all these death, these people, it doesn't quite end there. In the death of Rachel, something beautiful happens. Ben Oni, also Benjamin, oops, B-E-N. Now, this is interpreted lots of different ways. I'm giving you my personal opinion. This is my, this is not, you know, what else may think they want. I don't really care. Since God uses symbols all the time, this, of course, if you know, son of my sorrow, son of my death, which is what Rachel had named him. And Benjamin is son of, in most interpretations, means of many days. Son of old age or son of many days. The word Ben, by the way, means son. And Oni is pain or sorrow. And then Yamin is actually not a J, it's a Y. Yamin is a days. It comes from the word Yom, which means day. Some people argue, well, it could be in Yadmin. No, it's Yamin, it's days. It makes far, far more sense. In this story, what we're learning is that the death of Rachel, the purging process, purges someone who Jacob loves, right? So the purging process of you and I is going to purge someone whom God loves and whom we love. Who could that be? If you and I, yeah, Messiah. This death of Rachel purges someone that Jacob loves. Jacob, of course, obviously Joseph included. It's their tribe. She is the favored one. Is Messiah the favored one of God? Well, yeah. So is Rachel the favored one of Jacob. This death of her is a pretty nice representation of death of Messiah in this process. So her cleansing, the cleansing of the people, results in the death of someone whom Jacob loves. The cleansing of each one of us results in the death of someone God loves, who we love as well, Messiah himself. In that process, we learn, okay, so it's going to produce a sorrowful event, which death of one you love, is that sorrowful? Yes, it should be. Death of Messiah, was that sorrowful to God? Yes, it was. He even said so. He didn't like the event. So it was sorrowful, but it resulted in something else. The Ben Yadmin, which is son of days, Yadmin means many days, as in lifetimes and forever. As in forever. Son for ever. That's what is essentially what his dad's saying. You're son of my old age. You're son of many days. You're son forever. You'll always be the son, the favored one. So this sorrowful event, the purging process, the idols, the wickedness, resulted in the death of someone whom he loved, who Jacob loved. And it produced sorrowness. But that sorrowness then converted itself into a son forever. Benjamin's birth, the death of Rachel, Benjamin's birth, is a beautiful representation of Messiah's death and then converting into the son forever that lives forever, that's always the king of all things. That's where the symbolism comes from. So when we went through, oh, I erased already, the atonement process, and he got to meet God and be with God in Israel, and he got the eighth day, that's wonderful, that's pretty, that's great. And then we go to Shechem, which they have all the death of the evil, the wickedness, and all this process of cleansing. Let's go up the mountain of God, everybody. Let's go meet God at Bethel, which is similar to what Moses says. Let's go meet God and see the Ten Commandments. We get these blessings. These blessings, and this is a wonderful event. Oops. It requires something. Someone has to die. Someone whom you love must die. Not because they did something necessarily bad or right or wrong. They have to die to get the process finished. This death process results in sorrow, which was a sorrowful event for God, but also results in, at the end of it, he gets renamed son forever. You know, king forever. Does that make sense? Yes, Rose.
My right hand.
Yes, that is the comment from the belief that the word Yamim would be pronounced Yadmin or Yodmin. Yodmin. instead of Benjamin, Binyadmin, the D instead of an M. It's not spelled that way. But that's the belief that it could have come from there. But even if it did come from there, it's the same thing. The symbol doesn't change. That's one thing about the Torah is when God uses a symbol, even though you can have different variations of the word, it always means the same thing. The son of Sarah becomes son of my right hand. Well, where does the son fit? The right hand of God. So either way, they still work. They still fit correctly. Either interpretation, whether it believes you come from the word yod, which means hand, or yom, which means day. It means son forever, son of my right hand. In other words, you could word it, son of my right hand forever. If you want to shove them all together, a big little soup, so to speak. Well, whatever you want to call it. Either way, it's still the same symbolism. This death caused the death of someone who you loved. It resulted in, obviously, great sorrow for a son that was now loved. Of course, converts into a son forever or a son of the right hand. Makes no difference. It's the same symbolism. Any questions? Does that make sense? Okay. So the process from Jacob, let's recap real quickly, next 2 minutes, goes from he's leaving Padan Aram, he's leaving, going return to his home. He meets Esau. It is a process of being at one with his family to reunite, become back to one again. And after he goes back to one again, and they were accepted to God, he presents himself obviously to Esau, to God, the same process. They then have to go through a purging cleansing process, going through Shechem, going through their wickedness, going through their idols, clean up their house, clean up the inside as well as the outside, purge that which is evil. As a result, it may cost you something which you love. It may. And in fact, it does. In order to live. Because in order, Jacob, to get that blessing of you will inherit this land and all your descendants from now on is always going to be yours, it's going to cost you something. In this case, it costs the death of his wife. However, for us, it costs the death of God's son, Messiah. As a result, the son, who is a result from this death, because mind you, Benjamin is the result of Rachel's death. He's the one that came out, then she's the one who died. If he wasn't there, she wouldn't have died, so to speak. That's the physical imagery of what's happening in this story. So, in the result of that, the death, the son that was produced from that death becomes a son forever, or the son of the right hand of Jacob. So in this event, we're going from the purging idol process, Jacob is becoming symbolically in the place of God, the Father Creator. He's symbolically being in that place while his son is being birthed. And of course, the death of Rachel, the process happens. Does that make sense? See, symbolically, Jacob's temporarily taking the position, okay, I'm God. Rachel, you'll be, you know, Messiah, who's before he's dead. And then Benjamin, you're Messiah after he's dead, after he comes back from life. It's the three position symbol. And in this whole story, we learn and we see from this Torah reading that we have a cleansing process we go through, an atonement process we go through, and then we get to receive the blessing from God. Does that make sense? Yeah, I'm going to cover it again for a year from now. It's complicated. I get that. But holy days are complicated, and God's complicated. He's simple and complex at the same time. So when you have Torah cycles and you have reading cycles that have stories inside of stories, they're brain teasers, in my mind. They're fun to play with, and let's dissect them and find them out. That's what I share with you. It's not easy. I know it's complicated, but it's fun. And God's handiwork is very elaborate and very interesting to learn. It's interesting to learn.
Unto God, and the more you study and approved, the more secrets God reveals to you.
So let them reveal the secrets to all of you. No, it's interesting. It's a lot of work to understand these concepts. But God is a repeater. So this isn't just the only time these events occur in your Torah cycle. It happens again. There's more atonement stories. There's more sukkah stories. There are many more. Death and resurrection, rebrought back to life, stories. And we're supposed to learn from them that God trying to repeat from Adam and Eve all the way through, repeat himself again and again and again. This process never changes, regardless of how many years goes by, regardless who lives and who dies, what your ancestors were. It's always the same story. It's a process of, I need to be at one with God to cleanse up what I've done, whatever my past is, and I need to actually move forward with living, to receive the blessing that God's going to give me, this inheritance of land or inheritance of forever, living forever, everlasting life,
It requires certain things from me. And one of the things, I need to go through atonement. Not with just man, but with God. I need to go and dwell with Him, with Sukkah, alone. Me and God alone. It's a one-on-one relationship. And of course, he's on with the, I need to examine myself, the idols, as well as the people around me, and cleanse myself of them. They're not just a, oh, it's okay, you know, Joe Schmel, let's just wink and nod, it's all right. No, it's not. It's not acceptable. God wanted them cleaned, as Jacob purges, even though it costs something. It's a cycle process that every human goes through. You believe in God, it's going to cost you something. And this is the cycle, this is one example of the cycles what it goes through. Does that make sense to everyone? Hopefully it does. As a result, you get the forever blessing. You receive the blessing as explained to Jacob. You will live in this land forever. This is always going to be yours and your descendancy. You get the blessings you're after. That's what our goal is. All of us here are here to get that blessing. We want to live forever. No one wants to be dead. We all want to live and live and continue on living. That's the goal. That's the promise. To get it, we have to understand what God's teaching us. Does that make sense? Any questions? Yes, Alma.
Why didn't Jacob do anything when he learned about the daughter being raped? That's one. And the other question is, Israel doesn't eat that part of the sinew.
The sinew, right.
Where is that part?
The bottom half of the animal. Kosher rules prohibit any consumption from a four-legged creature, not birds, from about the hip bone back. So they prohibit we have like a
rump roast
or not. Correct. It's not kosher rules to prevent it. Because the sinew of the hip is inside that spot. Now that's kosher rules. That is not to say that's what God intended. That's kosher rules. So if you go to a butcher shop and say, I want a rump roast, you're not going to get it. They sell that to the people like, you know, the Gentiles. Oh, here's your rump roast, because they're not supposed to eat it. Yes.
Although in Israel, the butchers in Israel will go through the trouble of removing that sinew.
That's
but most
true.
Of the kosher butchers here don't bother because it's time-consuming.
Yes, it's very expensive to do.
You're not going to make up that cost, so just give it to the goy. Give it to the Gentiles.
It's cheaper. Yeah, the local butcher, it's not local at all. Like I went down in Oakland, where I went to years ago. It costs a fortune to buy any part of the animal, because the animal is only half the animal. They pay, for example, a cow. Great, the cow's meat, by 500 pounds of meat, give or take. Well, half the meat, the back half, they don't sell. So this $2,000 animal is now condensed to, instead of 500 pounds, you have like 250 pounds of it. It becomes really expensive. But the back half, they won't sell it to you because it is a lot of work. It's hard to remove this in. You're actually dissecting the meat very slowly, pulling the whole thing apart like a butterfly type of fan, and you're slowly pulling out the sinew, all the different connector tissues as well. It's too expensive. So they don't do it. So it's just say, forget the back half. Does that make sense? Okay. The questions. The daughter. Why didn't he do anything for the daughter? It wasn't his to do. It wasn't his job to do it. It was his son's job. Mind you, Jacob is now a relatively old man. Relatively. It is his son's task to take care of their family. That's their job. They have to learn what is right and what is wrong and actually obey what is right. I'm going to erase part of this because there's a sub-story with inside that. Not a really big one, it's really short. There's two common arguments or beliefs about that process. One, the most common one, is that Jacob didn't know what his sons were planning. Didn't know what they were going to do. So that this plan for the circumcision. I hate this marker. I shouldn't use the word hate. I dislike the marker. Circumcision. That plan, he didn't know about that. That was something his sons came up with. It pointed out they were working deceitfully or deviously with Shechem and Hamor. Most likely, the sons probably figured the men of Shechem would say, are you kidding me? No way! Because who would volunteer, oh yeah, I'll get myself cut open so you can have her as a wife?
Not in that area. No thanks. I'd rather not. I'll go do something else. I'll move. I'll change my hat from a Shechemite to any other name. They would say no. Why would you do that? That's insane. Just so your so-and-so's son, the king's son, can marry this other guy's daughter who I don't even care about. I have to get myself cut to do that? You're crazy. That's probably what they expected. It wasn't what they got. But the grass did look greener. Apparently, it looks really green. You go for that, you look great. So, Jacob, the circumcision was probably unknown.
No.
Thank you. Unknown to Jacob, but it wasn't necessarily known by his sons what the outcome was going to be. But they had figured that this was a worthwhile shot. So the circumcision unknown to Jacob. He didn't know what the plan was, but he knew that he, as roughly 75-ish year old man, wasn't going to do anything. He's an old man. You're not going to take on a whole city with one man. So he had to have his sons be there to actually address this issue. This event comes up again later with Reuben and the fact that he slept with the concubine, Bilhah. It's kind of like an aunt, sort of. It's kind of bizarre. But stepmother, sort of, to the third, whatever. The third stepmother there is. A wet nurse. Jacob hears about it, but doesn't do anything. It's not his to do. It's not his task to fix. This event, this circumcision idea, the rape, it wasn't supposed to be his to fix. And why isn't it his to fix? Because he can't. He can't actually fix it. How do I know he can't fix it? Where is Dina? Where physically is she in that story? With Shechem. Is Jacob going to say, no, you have to return my daughter? He could say it, but who's going to make him? Who's going to make me? Now, Shechem's pretty bold already, the boy. His father's pretty bold also. He's already a kidnapper and a rapist. He said, oh, I'm so sorry, you can have her back. Are you kidding me? The city's huge, and you're small. You either give her to us, or we just keep her. Jacob doesn't have the authority, physical ability to do anything about it to start with. So he's not going to say yes or no until his sons show up. His sons are supposed to take over the job. If you recall, back when Rebecca was being taken by Abraham's assistant, who did the negotiating? Laban. Well, what about Rebecca's dad? He was alive. He was there. He nodded. That's great. Laban does all the work. Laban does all the negotiating. If you never allow your sons to negotiate, do they ever learn? No. They become inept. Your sons have to learn to be leaders, learn to be men. Well, learning to then know what's right and wrong. The sons have to determine what is right and what is wrong. And Jacob knows it is his son's job, all of them, to learn how to handle these situations. It is their responsibility, not his. He can say it was bad, but it's not his job to fix it. It is his son's jobs to fix it. And of course, they do in their own way. Yes, David.
Well, in the end of that chapter, though, it says that then Jacob says to Simon and Levi, and this is after the fact, he's kind of like, you brought this trouble on me now.
Right.
And we're going to, the Canaanites and the Israelites.
They're all going to come up and attack us.
They're going to come and attack me and my household.
Yep. Your wife
is
all out.
He obviously didn't know about it.
Right.
He would have been against it even if he had known about it.
Right.
It seems to me.
Most likely. I don't think he knew their plan. Take it back. Sorry. He was obviously there within their hearing. He could hear the words being said, the circumcision and such and that. But what the plan of the two boys, they could have easily walked in and taken their daughter, their sister, and left. Because everybody sprawled out and not being able to do anything about it anyway. They didn't. They went in and they killed all the men. That was something that Jacob would not have known. Could not have been planned. No, it was only two brothers did it. Assuming the rest of them probably either didn't know or didn't plan on it. They weren't participating. So Jacob, the killing process, Jacob would not have known about. The circumcision, obviously, he did know about. But the killing of it, how they were going to do it, he would not have known. He said so. What have you done? Bad choice, guys. My sons, who were supposed to teach you how to lead, how to be good leaders, wrong move. You don't do this, because now everybody else around you can kill us all. You didn't plan ahead of time. And the boys are right. You don't allow Dina to be treated as a harlot. However, you didn't have to murder all the men of Shechem to do it. One man committed the crime. of kidnapping and rape. One man did it. You didn't have to kill everybody. On the other hand, that's how the story played out on purpose. Jacob uses the city of Shechem later on. He reuses it as a gift to his son, to Jacob. Oh, sorry, to Joseph. As actually, technically, it's Ephraim Manasseh, but that he uses it. He says, I have taken the city by my sword, which wasn't by his. Actually, his sons took it. It is now yours when you go back. It's a desolate town. It's now going to be yours. That's so he winds up keeping the reward or the plunder of the town. But he himself didn't know ahead of time what the plan was. But it's his son's responsibility to learn. It's no different than Moses and all of Israel. When Moses dies, what's the job of all of Israel? Follow the rules. Follow the lead. I gave 40 or 80 years of my life to this. Continue on. He implores him, the whole book of Deuteronomy, follow through, keep going, keep going, keep going. Don't stop, don't end with me. Well, Jacob's sons have the same thing. Jacob's getting old. Okay, boys, I've raised you. Follow the lead. Learn and do. They have to do it. If they don't do it, they won't figure it out. And they'll fail. Any questions or comments? Yes.
There might be a little bit in there about the father and the son, that Messiah and Yahweh. Obviously, the mechanisms are a little bit different than what we would expect, mm-hmm. but there's still the father reigns, but the son does the work, as you said. And
right.
That goes with that too.
Exactly. That symbolism is pretty consistent for each of the patriarchs. They do a certain thing, but eventually, while they're still alive, the sons have to start taking the responsibility, which is how Messiah and Father work together too. God's the creator of all things, but who's responsible to make it all work right? Well, the son is. You fix this problem, you deal with that, whatever, so-and-so, yada, yada, yada. That's his job. The father's the creator. Okay, I manage it all. I set it all up. Your job is to manage it. So, Jacob's example. Okay, yeah, fix it. It's all set up. Here, sons, fix it. Their choice of Levi and Simeon's choice to fix it cost them something themselves. They're probably in their upper teens, early 20s at this point. Probably some of that ballpark. The exact ages aren't spelled out for how old they are at this time. They're spelled out later on when they enter Israel or in Egypt. 20. So he's 25, yes, when our mind is, but God said that you're responsible wholly for everything you do at the age of 20 and up. So everything you've ever done, you can't blame mommy and daddy for it. 20 and up, it's all you. It's all your fault, your responsibility, you're responsible for all of it. So God point, 20 years old and up is all you, and Jacob's pointing at these two boys, look what you've done. There's a good chance they're near the age of 20. Good chance. Hard to say a year or two this way or that, but probably in that ballpark. They have to be strong enough to wield a sword and kill a whole bunch of men. Even though they are in a weakened state. You still have some strength. Any other questions or comments? I took you way over time, I apologize, but we did have a heater break. Say it again? Oh, it circumcised their hearts. Yeah. Okay, no comment there. Snide remark there. Let's close the prayer. Almighty God, a great Heavenly Father, thank you for teaching us and showing us what is good, what is right. Showing us what is fair and just in your ways, Father, help us to understand and apply what you teach us. That we learn and teach our children and grandchildren what is holy, what is good, and the work of your hands. May you bless us, Father, and may we bless others accordingly. In Yeshua's name we pray. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. Hallel.info.